are Radio Catskill.
Live from the Radio Catskill studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, behind every Amazon box delivered to your door is a workforce moving nonstop, especially at the sprawling warehouse in Orange County. But some Hudson Valley workers say the pace comes at a cost. Radio Catskill's Kimberly Izar reports on safety concerns inside the facility raised by employees and labor organizers, including heat stress and injury risks. A Times Union investigation looks at allegations of altered reports and questionable ammo purchases inside the Sullivan County Sheriff's Office. That's amid conflicting claims about an FBI probe. Radio Catskill's Patricio Rubio speaks with reporter Philip Pantuso about what deputies are saying and what's really going on, plus the Olana partnership and a winner in the best burger contest in the Catskills. First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. President Trump said today he's going to shorten the 50-day deadline he issued for Russia to end its war in Ukraine. He said earlier this month he'll impose new sanctions if there's no ceasefire by early September. Today, Trump said he's very disappointed in Russian President Vladimir Putin for recent strikes killing civilians in Ukraine, and he'll set a new deadline.
I'm going to make a new deadline of about 10 or 12 days from today. There's no reason in waiting. There's no reason in waiting. It's 50 days. I want to be generous, but we just don't see any progress being made.
Trump spoke in Turnberry, Scotland, at one of his golf resorts before a meeting with British Prime Minister Keir Starmer. The two leaders agreed that more must be done to ease the suffering in Gaza. While in Scotland, President Trump reached a new trade deal with the European Union yesterday. It will lower the rate at which Trump had threatened to tax EU imports. But European products will still be more expensive for Americans than before Trump took office. NPR's Lauren Freyer reports.
The European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen traveled to one of President Trump's golf resorts here to finish negotiations. Together with Trump, she announced this new trade framework that'll allow U.S. goods to enter the EU tax-free and put a 15% tariff on EU products sold in America. That would include European cars, but may not include certain pharmaceuticals. EU member states still need to approve the deal, and some details are still pending. Trump had threatened 30% tariffs on EU goods starting this Friday, which could have triggered economic shockwaves globally. And this deal halves that rate. Lauren Freyer, NPR News, Aberdeen, Scotland.
Investors are welcoming a new U.S. trade deal with the European Union at the start of a busy week for Wall Street. As NPR's Maria Aspen reports, the Dow was down 30 points in early trading.
President Trump says the United States has agreed to impose new taxes of 15% on imports from the European Union. Details remain sparse, but investors are relieved that these tariffs aren't as high as the 30% Trump had previously threatened. Now Wall Street is watching for other trade deals ahead of the president's Friday deadline to reach such agreements with dozens of countries. There's plenty going on at home this week as Amazon, Apple, and more than 150 big companies report quarterly earnings. The Federal Reserve also meets and is widely expected to hold interest rates steady despite Trump's ongoing pressure to lower them. Maria Aspen, NPR News, New York.
At last check on Wall Street, prices were moving higher. The Dow is up 37 points. The S&P is up 13. This is NPR News in Washington. Authorities in Michigan say they plan to file terrorism and assault with intent to murder charges against a suspect in a stabbing at a Walmart over the weekend. A man walked into a store in Traverse City and started stabbing people with a folding knife. 11 people were hurt. Investigators say it appears he had acted randomly and no one was specifically targeted. A relentless heat wave across the southeast U.S. has prompted advisories for millions of people in recent days, and temperatures are expected to intensify this week with little overnight relief. Tony Gonzalez of member station WPLN reports from Nashville, Tennessee.
It's hit at least 90 degrees for 26 days in a row and counting. The National Weather Service puts this streak in the top 10 in Nashville's recorded history. The city slogged through its hottest year on record in 2023, then was even hotter last year as climate change fuels a new normal. Health and emergency officials are worried about the coming days when the heat index could be around 110 degrees. Nashville Heat Patrols handed out some 3,000 bottles of water in the past few days, along with bus passes to cooling stations. Electricity demand is also surging. The Tennessee Valley Authority predicts more power needs than last summer's hottest span. For NPR News, I'm Tony Gonzalez in Nashville.
The Federal Aviation Administration is investigating an incident at Denver International Airport over the weekend. A jet had just taken off Saturday when a mechanical problem sparked a fire. Passengers used an emergency slide to evacuate. One person was injured. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org. And Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. Every time an Amazon box with that familiar black tape lands on your doorstep, it's the result of countless hours of work by hundreds of thousands of warehouse employees packing, stocking, and shipping products around the clock to keep up with demand. In the Hudson Valley, a massive 1 million square foot facility employs hundreds of Amazon workers in Orange County. But some of those workers say the job can become dangerous. That facility is known as SWF1. Radio Catskills' Kimberly Izar spoke with Amazon workers there and labor organizers who are raising concerns about safety issues, some of them serious, like heat exhaustion and frequent injuries. She brings us this report.
In June, the town of Wewayanda rejected a proposal to build a new 3.2 million square foot Amazon warehouse in Orange County. The town zoning board unanimously shot down the proposal because the building would have been over 30 feet taller than the town's restricted building height. The proposal drew mixed support and opposition to Amazon potentially expanding its footprint in New York's Hudson Valley area. Some of that opposition came from current Amazon workers at the SWF1 facility in Orange County. Kristen Hughes is one of those workers who strongly opposed the plan. At a June public hearing, she said she's seen too many of her Amazon coworkers settle for low wages and dangerous working conditions just to make ends meet.
I have no idea how many 18 and 19-year-olds I have seen break their bodies for this company. And then not be able to get workers' comp fulfilled. You are not helping local residents. You are not helping people in desperate need of jobs. Do not convince yourself of that. And when you go to sleep at night, if you work for this, I hope you realize that if you are pro-Amazon, you are anti-worker.
Roughly 20 miles from Wewayanda is an Amazon warehouse already up and running. It's the SWF1 Fulfillment Center, nestled in the small town of Rock Tavern, whose population is less than 3,000 people. Worker Nicolas Moran says most morning shifts start the same.
First thing in the morning, we get to work. We have a stand-up meeting, and we get to put all our PPE on and get on our order pickers to go. And I'm in the stow department, so I go and put things on the shelf, scan them onto the shelf, so that you can buy them on Amazon.com.
But it's what can happen during those 10-hour shifts that can become dangerous, says Moran. For months, workers have alleged unsafe and unfair working conditions. Moran says these conditions have continued well into the summer's hot weather conditions.
But, you know, and then people were in the trucks with heat exhaustion. You know, they're supposed to, we've been demanding that management rotate people out so that they're not in the trailers for too long unloading or loading the trailers. And, you know, management, you know, we'll talk a big game about safety, but oftentimes by, you can see it, our coworkers, they're on accommodations, they get injured, you don't see them for a while, and you find out that they got hurt on the job. So they've been pushed to the brink by management.
Moran has worked for Amazon for 3 years. He lives in Beacon, but drives into Rock Tavern for his shifts, where he says,
it's just the pace of work and expectations are just unreasonable and frankly dangerous for workers.
Moran says that high pressure from management to overstuff the warehouse bins with products leads to frequent injuries.
So we drive and we go into aisles that are very narrow aisles. There's your maybe an quarter inch from each side from each of the bins. And there are oftentimes the bins are stuffed, overstuffed, because workers are trying to meet some expectations that aren't reasonable. Like the management knows the building is full, but they stuff it over capacity. And oftentimes there are very few rules on where to put things, which causes people to put things really high up. And there's some of our coworkers who are not as tall have trouble reaching from the very top bins. You have to imagine that we're in a order picker that goes up like 30 feet up in the air. I'm trying to manage putting weigh boxes up to 50 pounds, trying to rearrange bins that have racking that is broken, sticking out, protruding, and then in our cages where we take the items in case of stowing. Otherwise, you put them in your cage behind you.
Right.
Those can also be broken and have the wiring can be separated from the frame so that they can also get caught on things. And they're just not. And then we have to also deal with coworkers, of course. You know, it gets very busy and management wants to micromanage and has expectations of like how fast things should take, which are just not reasonable. It's a big warehouse. You got to drive from one place to another, picking up large items and properly put them in the bin so that we don't hurt ourselves. Injuries happen quite often.
Like how common is it for a worker to injure themselves and what does that look like typically?
Oh, daily. Whether it's wrists, knees, backs is a common one, lower backs.
Moran says he previously broke his finger on the job after his finger was crushed between warehouse cages trying to move them. In a viral TikTok video with over 8,000 comments, several dozen Rock Tavern workers can be seen sharing their concerns directly with management. One big issue raised is a sudden change to their break schedule, from two shorter breaks to one longer break, which some workers say could lead to more injuries and exhaustion.
We have legitimate issues.
We work really hard day in, day out, and we are not robots. We are human beings. We need rest.
And we need those breaks. Those are very important for our safety.
Same week I had an abdominal injury here. Two other stowers herniated themselves. Our department was turned into a hernia factory.
Okay,
and since then,
everyone,
we've been handed candy.
Radio Catskill reached out to Amazon regarding these worker allegations. Amazon spokesperson Steve Kelly wrote in an email to Radio Catskill that, quote, employee safety is our top priority at SWF1 and across our network, end quote. Kelly says Amazon has reduced their recordable incident rate by 31% in the U.S. and already has heat safety procedures and training in place to minimize risk. He wrote, quote, our approach includes a commitment to manageable workloads. Employees are encouraged to work with intention, not speed. We have comprehensive prevention procedures and training to ensure workplace safety, including heat safety protocols that help employees recognize signs of heat-related illnesses, understand risk factors, follow hydration guidance, and respond to suspected incidents, end quote. But last December, a U.S. Senate committee led by Senator Bernie Sanders accused Amazon of manipulating workplace injury data to make its warehouses seem safer than they are. The federal investigation found that Amazon workers were nearly twice as likely to be injured compared to other warehouse workers in the sector. For Amazon worker Niklas Moran, he says he's tired of being told to work faster, not safer. For months, he and his coworkers have been trying to form a union with the help of Teamsters and local nonprofit For the Many to advocate for better wages and worker conditions.
We have the power to hold management accountable. To all the Amazon workers, it's time to get involved and time to fight back.
For the Many's labor organizer, Vanessa Sid, said trying to organize a union at the Rock Tavern facility hasn't been easy. She claims Amazon has been doubling down on union busting efforts, like putting anti-union signs in employee bathrooms.
Unfortunately, Amazon is union busting some of our
leader workers are pushing for a fair contract and they're talking to their coworkers about unionizing. But Amazon keeps popping up with these false allegations of harassment. If you don't feel comfortable, don't give out your phone number or don't agree to meet with someone outside after work. And they've also put up in their bathrooms what they call installments, which is like little messages. And they say, say no to union. It's bad. We care about you, which is why we're telling you. But in that same facility, there was a man that had a heart attack. There was another girl who was 19. She's still working there. She ended up falling off of her machine and she blew her whistle. She called. Nobody came to her for an hour and 30 minutes and an ambulance had to come and get her. So there's ongoing issues at that facility, but workers are still trying to push through.
For now, Moran says he'll continue fighting for better worker conditions. He said he and his team look out for each other.
We keep on building and educating our coworkers about what is a union, what a union is not. And we keep on having those conversations and we continue building work, a rank and file participatory union that where the workers are centered. And I think that's the ongoing process and that's what we keep on working on.
In Liberty, I'm Kimberly Izar for Radio Catskill.
And Amazon spokesperson Steve Kelly wrote in response to allegations about union busting efforts, quote, our employees have the choice of whether or not to join a union. We believe that both decisions should be equally protected, which is why we talk openly, candidly, and respectfully about these topics, actively sharing facts with employees so they can use that information to make an informed decision, end quote. We'll take a break, and when we come back, altered documents, bulk ammo, conflicting stories about the FBI. A Times Union report digs into allegations rocking the Sullivan County Sheriff's Office. We'll learn more about what's going on next.
I'm Stephen Dubner. On the next Freakonomics Radio, we speak with one of the smartest and most compelling people in contemporary theater.
David Adjemi is my name, and playwright is my game.
We talk about what it costs to lead a creative life these days.
There were times when I really thought I was losing my mind. It got really, really bad for me.
That's next time on Freakonomics Radio. Tuesday at 1 p.m. on Radio Catskill.
100 years ago, a small town in Tennessee became the stage for an historic legal battle. The Scopes Monkey Trial pitted science against scripture, a rift still relevant in debates over the role of religion in public schools.
History doesn't repeat itself because it's not identical, but it rhymes. It echoes.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. The impact of the Scopes trial a century later. That's on the next On Point.
Monday morning at 11 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. A new investigation by the Times Union looks into some serious allegations involving the Sullivan County Sheriff's Office. In the article, Hudson Valley editor Philip Pantuso and reporter Lana Bellamy detail claims that accident reports were altered at the direction of Undersheriff Eric Chabote and that bulk ammunition may have been purchased using the department's tax-exempt status for personal use. While Chavoti and Sheriff Mike Schiff deny any wrongdoing and downplay reports of an FBI investigation, several current and former deputies told the Times Union they were recently questioned by federal agents. Radio Catskill's Patricio Rubio spoke with Philip Pantuso to learn more about what's going on.
To us, covering the race, that this was at least an issue that some people were talking about, whether or not there was an FBI investigation into the Sullivan County Sheriff's Office and what that investigation might have been about. So we had been trying to look into that along with many other news organizations for a couple of months. And what we are reporting in this story, which is new, we know of at least four, and we spoke with three current and former members of the Sheriff's Office who say that federal agents questioned them in recent months, one as recently as this month, about a couple of things. An accident report that was allegedly, I don't have to say allegedly because the sheriff admits this, that was amended under circumstances that there's some disagreement over, and some ammunition purchases that Undersheriff Eric Chibodi made and had sent to the sheriff's office. These mostly date to 2021 and 2022.
So just to make it clear, what was the original reason supposedly the FBI was probing into the sheriff's office? It was because of that amendment to an accident report.
That's right. And one thing that all sides here are in agreement on is that federal agents back in 2021 and possibly in 2022 were speaking with members of the sheriff's office and maybe other members in county government, such as the purchasing department. Sheriff Mike Schiff, Undersheriff Eric Chibodi, the former county attorney, Mike McGuire, and the county legislature chair, former county legislature chair, Rob Doherty, all say that. Now, what they say is that the FBI looked into this and declined to open a formal investigation. Mm. So there's a bit of a semantics game here about what's an investigation, when, like, what qualifies as that. That's why we felt the only reason this was really a story for us was because we have sources who are saying that there are agents that are still asking questions. And yes, I'm not exactly sure what they were initially asking questions about. Certainly that accident report factored into it heavily. There's been reporting on that going back several months now. We also know that a retired Lieutenant Paul Slavik forwarded to the FBI a ammunition purchase that Chibodi made that Slavik thought was fishy or unusual. This was a purchase of a large purchase of ammunition back in September of 2021 that Chibodi had shipped to the sheriff's office. And it was on it was delivered on a big pallet. And Slavik just thought that was unusual, basically, that there would be so much ammunition that was being ordered for personal use to the sheriff's office. Now, the Slavik and a couple of other members of the department believe that Chibodi was ordering this, was basically using the sheriff's office tax exempt status to save on the ammunition that he was ordering for personal use. Chibodi denies that.
The sheriff, you know, when I interviewed him and other folks interviewed him, he denied that there was an FBI probe going into it. But like I said, you have other folks in the office saying that they have spoken to the FBI. And Slavik released recordings that allegedly show Chibodi instructing the staff not to speak with the FBI. And Chibodi denies giving those instructions, saying that he was only advised of officers of their rights, I guess, right?
That's right. Yeah. So these people probably remember this. It was a big deal at the time. One day before the end of voting in the primary, Slavik posted those recordings to a public Facebook page. This was while Schiff and Chibodi were continuing to deny the federal probe. Slavik said that these recordings proved that there was at one point a federal probe. And of course, he's also saying on the record to us in this story that he believes there still is one because he was interviewed as recently as this summer and knows of at least one other individual who was as well. So these recordings, they allege to capture Sergeant Chris Lopez and Blake Muthig, who is both the chief of patrol and of internal affairs. These are conversations that Paul Slavik said he had with them back in August of 2021, where they are both allegedly describing to him the conversations that they had with Chibodi, during which Chibodi instructed them not to talk to the FBI. Chibodi's explanation to us about that was that he was simply advising them of their rights. He said, just like if it was an administrative investigation, I would have advised Sergeant Lopez that he could seek counsel, so it's nothing out of the ordinary. He said, at that point, I didn't even know that I was involved, but they never came and talked to me, and they never came and talked to the sheriff.
As a reporter, as an editor, do you also have to take into account that what is his motivation? Like, if he has an axe to grind with the company, with the sheriff's office, does that taint the reporting in any way?
you know, Paul Slavik, to be clear, has made no secret that he feels like there is a deeper level of corruption in the sheriff's office and that this FBI investigation may be looking into additional things. You know, as a responsible journalist, it's incumbent upon us to, you know, somebody in that position can be useful to a reporter or editor because they're incentivized to be a whistleblower, right? They feel like there's some kind of wrongdoing going on. They want to draw attention to it in hopes of, you know, hopefully correcting it. One way of doing that is in the media. But as a responsible journalist, you have to balance that prerogative against the more, you know, axe to grind, the more personal one, as you described. And there is nothing in this story that is sourced only to Paul Slavik. And as I had said earlier, I don't think this would be a story if we didn't talk to other current and former deputies whom we interviewed separately from Slavik, who said similar things, at least about what FBI agents were asking them about. Nobody's making quite as explosive of allegations as former Lieutenant Slavik is, but you know, you won't really find those in the story because we could not corroborate them independently.
And just to go back on the ammunition, you know, I see that in your reporting that you did extensive reporting on contacting other sheriff's office about their policies and basically saying that this shouldn't have been allowed. And this is something that was spoken to the FBI. Do you know if that particular thing is being investigated more into?
All we know, or all we're reporting anyway, is that FBI agents spoke to these current and former deputies about the ammunition purchases and the altered accident report. That's what those folks told us. We're reporting only that the FBI was asking questions about that, not that they opened a formal investigation into it necessarily. About the ammunition purchases, Tivode's explanation for that was that he would purchase ammunition, and rather than have it sent to his home, where he was concerned that there would be porch pirates or something like that, he had it sent to his office, just because the time of day of the delivery meant that that's where he would be. The county attorney, he told us at the time that the county attorney knew of this arrangement and was fine with it. And I spoke with the county attorney, Mr. McGuire, and he confirmed that. And he said that it was kind of a regular thing that was happening at the sheriff's office. People would have Christmas gifts and cell phones and, in this case, ammunition sent to their work address. And I also spoke with Sheriff Schiff. He also confirmed that he had that arrangement with his undersheriff, and he saw nothing wrong with that at the time. He said, I had no problem with it. It didn't violate any rules we have. I thought it was prudent. But as you sort of alluded to, we were wondering if that type of arrangement whereby a high-ranking law enforcement officer orders ammunition for personal use to his agency's office with the approval of his boss was typical. And so we queried a number of other law enforcement offices, mostly sheriff's offices, for this story. Some of them spoke to us on background. Some of them spoke to us on the record. The ones on the record are in the story. We did not hear from anyone saying that they knew of anything similar to this that had happened either recently or before a law changed back in September of 2022 that would make that much harder to do now. And in fact, you know, we heard on the record from the Orange County Sheriff's Office saying that this course of action does not align with current administration policies and their county's procurement process, therefore it would not be authorized. And the Dutchess County Sheriff's Office saying we're not aware of anything like that happening at this sheriff's office. And the sheriff does not anticipate giving his approval for similar requests in the future. And to be clear, there were many other sheriff's offices that we also spoke with, just in sort of background capacity. But what we're reporting is that arrangement between Schiff and Tivode, to have Tivode's personal ammo sent to the sheriff's office, which seems to have been one thing, at least, that the FBI was questioning deputies about is a pretty unusual arrangement.
So what has been sort of the FBI's stance on this? Was this sort of the official response to whether an investigation is active or not?
The FBI pretty famously does not comment or confirm on the existence of an investigation, and they declined to do so in this case as well, to the Times Union. Chobody and Schiff's defense during the primary, and they also reiterated this in interviews with us as we were reporting this story, has been that a rejection letter rejecting a FOIL request that Nate Henderson of Sullivan's Legacy, which is an independent expenditure group that backed Schiff's reelection campaign in the primary, that rejection request was confirmation that there was no or is no investigation. Henderson, the leader of that group, had filed an open records request asking for any records of an FBI investigation into the Sullivan County Sheriff's Office between 2017 and 2024. Now, one thing any journalist can tell you is that if you file a records request for documents related to an investigation and that investigation is still open, any law enforcement agency is going to reject that. We also feel that the rejection letter is not proof that there was or was not an investigation. But that's been what Schiff and Chobody's defense has been.
And just to remember, Ryan's folks, the only reason that this sort of came up, the FBI investigation, is because Slavik's testimony that was uncovered, right?
That's right, yeah. Slavik's testimony in a disciplinary hearing for a detective. And then, of course, it was a big issue in Tim Diamond's campaign.
Yeah. Philip, is there anything else that we have not touched on? Do you want folks to know about this article?
There's so much in the article. You know, a lot of it may not be new to folks who have kept abreast of the River Reporter's reporting, mm-hmm. in particular in recent years. And I know details of that have been discussed in various programs on Radio Catskill. But there is some new stuff in the article, and there's a lot of background and a lot of context. And we have the parties here kind of on the record with their defense and I think offering the most fulsome explanation that they had yet as to what was going on or what they feel the ramifications of that have or have not been.
Yeah, exactly. It was like a lot of this information that folks do know about because it was just posts on Facebook and stuff like that. Now we have a legit news organization asking about this and those folks going on the record and things like that. So that's, to us, that's news. That is actually officially done because otherwise it was just Facebook posts, people, you know, bickering back and forth.
So, don't get your news from Facebook. That's the other thing I'll say.
Yeah, exactly. All right, Philip, thank you so much for this. We really appreciate it. We're talking to Philip Pontuso from the Times Union Hudson Valley Bureau. Again, thank you so much for this, Philip. I do really appreciate it.
You got it. All right, take care.
And we'll take a break. When we come back, we're talking Pike County watersheds. This is Radio Catskill.
Hi, it's Catherine Marr, CEO of NPR. Federal funding for public media has been eliminated. That means that the NPR network is moving forward in an uncharted future. But our commitment to you will never waver. Please give today to support the kind of journalism that democracy relies upon. Here's how to make your gift to this station, and thank you.
Make your donation at wjffradio.org.
It's Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Did you know that Pike County is home to 18 watersheds? They're important to providing the Catskills in the Delaware River Valley with clean drinking water. Radio Catskill's Kimberly Izar visited Shohola Falls in Shohola, Pennsylvania to see these waterways up close. She spoke with Rachel Marks, watershed specialist at the Pike County Conservation District, about how climate change is impacting them to how to keep a watershed-friendly home.
Why don't we start with, if you want to just explain what exactly a watershed is and how you interact with them in your work?
Yeah, that's perfect, actually. So, yeah, what is a watershed specialist even? So watersheds are, the way that I like to describe it is kind of a common drainage area. So it's basically an area in which all of the water that falls through rain or maybe runs down a river eventually ends up at a common point. Right. So, for example, Pike County, we're in the larger Delaware River watershed. So that means that any water from streams, rivers, rain events will eventually make its way down to the Delaware River. you know, these watersheds and waterways are, they're so critical to the state because, as you mentioned, for drainage, how do the watersheds play a significant role in making sure that things don't overflood? So watersheds are really cool in that they are all kind of nested within one another, right? So right now we're near the Shohola Creek, and that's going to eventually find its way downstream. So we know when it rains further up in the watershed where that water is going to eventually go, right? So we'll see here if we were to get a heavy rain event, even where we are now, eventually, maybe within the next 24 hours, it'll make its way down to the Delaware River. Mm-hmm. And that'll eventually make its way down the Delaware River and into the Delaware Bay. So we kind of are able to use our watersheds and the knowledge of how these different water bodies are intermingled with one another to look at, you know, predicting maybe where some high waters may end up and things like that.
And, you know, just out of curiosity, well, one, I love the title of watershed specialist. I think that's such a fun role. How did you become so knowledgeable about watersheds?
Oh, my gosh. So I did go to Kutztown University. So I have a 4 years degree in ecology. But a lot of the learning is really on the job stuff. You know, Pike County is a really beautiful, special county. Northeastern Pennsylvania as a whole is just, will always have a place in my heart. But with that, it comes, you know, very unique situations, right? So we have a lot of forested land in Pike County, which is fantastic and helps protect a lot of our water bodies with all of those nice trees and greenery. And with that, though, we maybe are a little more concerned about things like invasive plant species and things like that. So it really influences the things that matter to the people of Pike County and then the things that I go ahead and learn more about so that I can help the people of Pike County with those issues.
Well, I was so excited to meet you even before we had emailed because you had written this fantastic article about geology and how geology affects, you know, the watersheds. And I learned how watersheds can get bigger and smaller. Tell me a little bit more about that.
Yeah. So like I said, watersheds are common drainage points, right? So they really depend heavily on our geologic formations, like our mountains, directly influence, you know, where the water's going to run off to, right? So if you're at the top of a mountain and it rains on, you know, at the top, the water's either going to go down one side or down the other side, right? So that's kind of what we like to imagine as our watershed divide. Mm-hmm. And that's a really big deal when it comes to determining the size and shapes of our watersheds. You know, and like I said, they do nest within one another. So, there can be very small watersheds that go into bigger and bigger and bigger watersheds. And it really just depends, again, on that geology.
You spend a lot of time by the water and taking care of the land and the waterways. I'm curious how, if at all, you've seen climate change impact our watersheds.
We definitely have. I mean, so especially this year, we've seen a lot of more intense rain events happening more frequently, right? And that intensity of that rain really influences the force of the water that hits the surface. But then oftentimes when we do have a lot of water all at once, that rain doesn't get the chance to kind of soak back into the ground. When it is really fast, it kind of is more likely to become runoff and pick up, you know, sediment and some other items as well. And then with that, you know, we've seen, of course, in the last several years, an increase in development in our area. And that can also add to some of our runoff concerns, right? So as we develop more areas, we are removing some natural spaces and maybe putting in some more what we like to call impervious areas. So those are areas like parking lots, rooftops, things like that, that really don't allow natural water to slow down and soak into the ground. It really just runs off and can sometimes gain speed or pick up things from the roadways and stuff of that nature.
I want to spend a little bit of time talking about what we're seeing at the federal level and how that's kind of impacting possibly your work or even just Pennsylvania locally. The Trump administration has cut billions of dollars in federal grants and programming that directly impact, you know, the environment, climate, etc. I'm curious if how if at all this is impacting your work locally or any of the partner organizations you work with.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So thankfully, the funding, a lot of my funding comes from the state, which is right now very stable. However, we do work with a lot of organizations at the federal level. So commonly, one of our big partners right now is the Natural Resource Conservation Service, or NRCS. And they're responsible for a ton of technical assistance with agriculture, even as it comes to implementing projects. So we do a lot of work with them to design new agricultural best management practices for our farmers in our area. That's not an area that we have expertise in when it comes to the specific designs and stuff like that. So unfortunately, with the lack of funding that's available to the people of Pike County through funding cuts to NRCS, as well as reduction in staff causing less availability for technical assistance. And then that does come down to the local level. So we do rely heavily on them for different funding sources, like they have an EQIP grant, and we're also doing an agricultural conservation assistance program right now. And we do work heavily with them on some of the design aspects, some of the technical assistance. So that could cause unavailability of funds and assistance to our local Pike County residents, or in the very least, I'm assuming some sort of delay.
That's really unfortunate to hear that potentially technical assistance, which directly impact residents, could be a potential loss for you guys. I'm curious what you're hearing from the community about what they need right now.
Yeah, we have actually started really trying to educate our community about drinking water and source water protection lately. Pike County is 100% dependent on groundwater for our daily water needs. So that means every single person in Pike County, if they want to run the sink, if they want to get in the shower, that water is going to come at the end of the day from groundwater. And it's hard to envision it, right? Because we stand above the surface all the time. It's not something that we see. But it is also susceptible to human activity, right? So we are trying to raise awareness on that. But we do work a lot with EPA on stuff like that. And we work with Pennsylvania DEP. So we'll see how it all shakes out as time goes on here. But we are trying to bring also, like I said, some agricultural programs to Pike County and make it so that, you know, we don't have a ton of agriculture in Pike County. We have a lot of forests, like I said. But we're trying to make that program more accessible to Pike County residents. So perhaps maybe looking at forestry practices a little bit more under that umbrella as opposed to traditional agriculture, like having a beef farm.
Well, that actually leads me really nicely into my next question, just in terms of what are, you know, some best tips or advice that you have for everyday residents that they can do to also take care of their land?
Yeah, absolutely. So that's one of the biggest things that we like to try to drive home is that, you know, we talk about some of these heavy topics, but it's not all doom and gloom. There are things that people can do at their homes or in their workplaces or wherever you are to try to make a difference, right? So we talked about today about stormwater, right? So there are things you can do at your house to help mitigate that. For example, being cognizant of where your gutters may discharge water from storm events. So there are things like rain barrels that you can try to use at home to help save some water. Rain gardens are a beautiful way to help mitigate some storm flow. And we also encourage a variety of things like planting native species wherever you can, making sure that you maintain these nice green spaces when you can. And even things like maintaining your septic system, disposing of household hazardous waste properly. There's a million things that we can do. And we have a whole section on our website of different practices people can do. We actually have a brochure called A Homeowner's Checklist for a Watershed-Friendly Home. So those are some of the main things that we try to drive home, right? There are little things that we can all try to do to make a difference.
Thanks to Kimberly Izar for that report, speaking to Rachel Marks, watershed specialist at the Pike County Conservation District. And be sure to check out Kim on Farm and Country Saturdays at 10 a.m. This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Now, cultural reporter Valerie Manzi is speaking with Carolyn Keough, Director of Education and Programs at the Alana Partnership, exploring how the historic site continues to evolve as a dynamic cultural destination. Olana was once the home of Hudson River School painter Frederick Church, and it's inspiring new generations through education and its stunning landscape.
Good morning, Carolyn, and welcome to Radio Chatskill.
Good morning. So happy to be here.
Carolyn, you are the Educational Public Programs Director at the Olana Partnership. First of all, for folks who don't know and are not familiar with Olana, can you tell us what is Olana?
Absolutely. I'd be happy to. Olana is the 250-acre artist-designed landscape and home designed and lived in by the 19th century artist Frederick Church. So folks may be familiar with the name Frederick Church. He was a very famous landscape painter, but he was also so much more than that. You know, he was a landscape designer. He also was a family man and lived at the 250-acre property with his wife, Isabel, and his four children. And currently, Olana State Historic Site is a public park open to everyone and free to visit, you know, anytime, 8 a.m. to sunset, 365 days a year. I work for the Olana Partnership, which is the nonprofit that works in very close collaboration with New York State to operate programming and other offerings on site.
Can you tell us a little bit about what's coming up at Olana?
Yeah, absolutely. So Olana, you know, as I mentioned, we're very deeply steeped in the history of the 19th century, you know, thinking about Frederick Church and his legacy as a landscape painter, as an artist who was deeply invested in the natural world, thinking about the regional environment and the landscape in the Hudson River Valley. But we always bring a little bit of the contemporary moment to the site. And every so often we have wonderful contemporary exhibitions that are up for limited times where we really try to activate some of the stories of the site. So currently we just opened our summer exhibition, which is on view through the beginning of November. And it's an outdoor installation of two artworks by a wonderful artist, Ellen Harvey and Gabriela Salazar. And this is a really exciting opportunity for folks who might be visiting the site, walking their dogs, or just, you know, taking a walk on the property to see contemporary art in the landscape for a limited time. So these two installations, as I mentioned, are by contemporary artists, and one is by the artist Ellen Harvey. Her piece is titled Winter in the Summer House, and she really activated a part of the site with a three-dimensional structure inspired by a church's potential summer house, which maybe was, we don't know much about it, but potentially it was a structure a little bit farther from the main house on the site. And then there's also a wonderful activation in our historic farm complex by the artist Gabriela Salazar, where she's focusing a little bit on the ways in which the church family were heating and cooling the site during the 19th century. And so her piece actually is housed in the historic footprint of the ice shed, the woodshed and the ice house, and her piece is called A Measure of Comfort, Cake and Cord. And so these two installations are on view, as I mentioned, until the beginning of November, and we have a wealth of wonderful programs and opportunities to engage with these pieces throughout the summer.
I noticed here you have an Indigenous medicine walk.
Yes, I'm so glad that you mentioned that. We're hosting Misty Cook in next month in July, and Misty's going to be participating in a series that's part of this exhibition. The exhibition is called What's Missing, because we're really focusing on, the two artists are focusing on stories of structures or stories of the site that are not visible to the naked eye when you come to Olana to enjoy a picnic or a walk with family and friends. And similarly, we're enlisting the help of wonderful experts and scholars to lead programs that really highlight the kind of missing histories or missing stories on the site that we want to spend some time focusing on. So Misty Cook is going to be joining us. She's a member of the Stockbridge Munsee Nation, and she's going to be joining us to talk a little bit about the Mohican traditions of using some of the flora in our landscape for medicinal purposes. And so I think there's going to be a lot to learn during that walk and talk from Misty about how we can kind of turn to the our plant neighbors for some assistance and some of the traditions of doing that within the Indigenous community.
And I see here that among the numerous programs you have going, you have programs for children and families.
Absolutely.
at art making. You have, let's see here, you're part of the Hudson Film Festival. You have music. I mean, you are doing a lot up there, and I think Frederick Church would be very proud.
We like to think so. You know, I often joke that a measure of a positive program is, we sit back and we think, would Frederick Church like that? And, we sometimes are very excited when we think that he would. So I'm glad to hear that. But I think, what we're trying to do with the wealth of our programs this summer is really provide opportunities for, all ages and folks from many different backgrounds to join us and participate in the site and in some of the themes that we can kind of dive into with the wonderful history and the beautiful collection here at Olana. So as you mentioned, we see this site very much as a site of artwork and creation. And so it certainly was a site of contemporary art in the 19th century, and it is again today with some of our temporary installations, but it also is a site of art making. And so we have a series of programs that we're so excited and thrilled to offer. One is our art making in the afternoon, which is a free drop-in program designed for families and groups of all ages. We host that in our Wagon House Education Center on the third Saturday of every month. And so in addition to that opportunity, we also have a family tour that we offer earlier in the afternoon from 1 to 2, and that's also free. So if you have a family audience with younger folks or, students who are looking for something to do over the summer months, on the third Saturday of every month, it's a great opportunity if you want to take an active family-oriented tour of the inside of the house interiors and then hop on down to our education center and get your creative juices flowing. So it's a really fun opportunity to provide free and accessible art making and creativity for anyone who finds themselves on site.
And I don't want to end the interview without saying that you also are having a Bollywood dance workshop.
We're hosting a range of performers, musicians, and artists this summer as part of our Third Thursday initiative to engage our local audience and our community in activities and performances on site. And so one of those, as you mentioned, is our Bollywood dancing workshop. I would also love to do a quick plug for our July 3rd Thursday. Third, we'll be joined by Mariachi Sitlali, a mariachi band, to usher in the summer season and really herald the first evening concert performance of the season. Subsequently, in August and September, we'll be joined by two more bands for our Third Thursday performances, including Heard World, a world jazz band, which will be doing a wonderful performance on August 21st, and Andes Manta, who will be performing in September Ecuadorian folk music. And part of what we're thinking about when we're bringing on Arobi Hanif, who's doing our Bollywood dancing workshop, Mariachi Sitlali, Heard World, and Andes Manta, is thinking about some of the cultures and places that church was inspired by or visited. And so, it's a little known fact, but church was deeply inspired by Mexico. It was a place that he visited about 17 times in his life. So to honor that, we're going to be kicking off our summer music series with mariachi band. So come and enjoy the fun. It's totally free and will be happening from 6 to 7 p.m. next month.
Before we end, would you please share your website address with our listeners?
Absolutely. We're at www.olana.org. And if you're interested in seeing our full list of programs, you can go to olana.org/programs. And if you have any questions about any of what we've been talking about, feel free to reach out to me directly. My email is education@olana.org. I'm always happy to answer questions or hear thoughts about what we have and what we're doing. It's been an exciting year so far, and we have a really exciting summer season ahead of us.
Well, thank you so much, Carolyn, for taking the time during this busy season.
Absolutely. So excited to be here. Thanks for chatting with me.
And thanks to culture reporter Valerie Manzi for that. You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. And after weeks of sizzling competition among local chefs and burger aficionados, one burger has risen to the top of the best burger in Sullivan County competition. Chef Brett August is the mastermind behind this countywide cook-off, and he's joining us now to reveal his winner. Chef, good morning.
Tim, thanks for having me.
Yeah, now let's remind folks, you decided you personally went out on this mission to have the best burger in Sullivan County. Remind folks about what motivated you besides having a lot of burgers.
Totally. So, Cooking in the Catskills, my Instagram site. I wanted everybody to know and share throughout Sullivan County the best burger competition. So through cooking in the Catskills, I tasted 10 burgers, or actually 11 burgers throughout the county that I thought were the best, or I feel super, super delicious, and came out with a winner. It was really hard, though.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Really, really hard. It was like, I lost sleep.
Who took home the title, and what made this burger stand out to you?
Okay, so first thing, there's a lot of restaurants in the area.
A lot of great stuff.
So if you're up by Upward Brewery or the Junction, they're really, really good burgers up there. Really, really good. But if you're down here, man, you got to hit Starters on Broadway in Monticello.
Okay.
Chef Dan makes a burger that reminds me of the Corner Bistro in New York City.
Okay.
It is that good.
It's called Starters?
Starters, yep, on Monticello.
In Monticello,
on Broadway.
All right.
It is so good. Juicy, full of flavor, and just brings back all these memories of just like deliciousness and heaven.
So there was this
like,
kind of
so good
memory thing that like pushed it toward the top for you a little bit too. This like old school burger.
It's really good. I mean, everybody makes a great burger. Yeah. You know, everybody in this county really tries super hard. But I mean, you know, you can get ground beef and make a patty, or you can get a special blend. And that's the difference.
So were there any surprising burgers that you discovered or something creative that you discovered in this process as well?
Well, I got to tell you, the Heron makes a killer burger. It's like eating this Burger King Whopper that's insanely delicious. I mean, they're right up there. The Junction, they're really good. They have this peppery crust that's insane. If you want a homemade bun, which is outrageous, the Old Foundation, he makes his own bun, his own bread. So when you're biting in this burger, it's like, oh. God. So there's a lot of great chefs that are killing it. Just like they love food. And it was great to see. And that's what I wanted to focus. I wanted to let people know.
And part of what you're doing through your Instagram, Cooking in the Catskills as well, is bringing attention to the local food scene here.
That's what it's about.
Yeah.
That's what it's all about. Because I sell food to a lot of the guys. I focus on showcasing them and their talents and letting people know they're out here.
And how's the response been so far? Have you gotten any kind of feedback there on who you crowned?
I got a lot going on.
Okay.
Believe it or not, I got a lot. Yeah, they're really excited. They're actually looking forward to the next competition.
I was going
to
ask you, is there another one coming up for next year?
I think we're going to do a chicken
sandwich. Oh, you're going to go into the other areas. Okay.
Yeah, because everybody loves chicken. Everybody's doing chicken. It's on the menu. It's a good price point. And everybody's already texting me, Brett, listen, you know, I'm ready to go. It's crunchy. It's delicious, blah, 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 blah. So it's fun. You know, it just keeps them excited. You know, it's passion.
Yeah, and it is great that you're, you know, shining this light on what everybody's doing. And while you're saying, you know, best, you're definitely showing off everything that's going on in the area.
Yeah, because everybody's really the best in my eyes, because food is really hard to do. You know, I mean, you're in a kitchen, you're sweating, even being an owner. So, you know, it's just wonderful that you gave me the opportunity to do this. So thank you to the radio station. I love you guys. And thank you to all the chefs out there. Kick ass. Keep going.
Yeah. Do you have a personal favorite burger or secret tip for making a perfect one at home? You mentioned the restaurants, of course, but anything home?
If you follow Cooking in the Catskills, I've been cooking burgers nonstop to promote these guys. But it's definitely a really good blend. You need a special blend. You need a really good patty. Like, you can buy ground beef at the store, but it's not going to do it. You need a really good blend, a short rib, chuck, that type of thing. And you need high heat. You need to really sizzle that, lock in those flavors.
Yeah.
And you got to salt it. Season's the number one thing. A lot of cats don't do that.
Chef Brett August, he is revealing the best burger in Sullivan County. We're moving on to the best chicken sandwich, I think. So we'll learn more about that. And the Instagram is Cooking in the Catskills.
Cooking in the Catskills.
Hey, thanks so much.
Thanks, Tim. I appreciate it.
All right. That's going to do it for this edition of Radio Chatskill. I'm hungry for lunch now. And we appreciate you listening. Thank you. We'll do that. That's all for this edition of the show. We'll catch you tomorrow. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFRadio.org.
I'm Jessie King. On this week's 51%, we speak with attorney Heather Lothrop of the Urban Justice Center about what immigrant survivors of domestic violence should know as they're planning to leave an abusive partner or bring them to court.
The partner can use their status as a threat, as a way to coerce.
This week on 51%.
Monday night at 8 on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at WJFFradio.org. You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Abundant sunshine and humid today, high 86. Clear tonight, low 65. Tomorrow, sunny and a high near 90. Looks like it's going to cool off on Thursday to 71 with some scattered thunderstorms in the forecast. On Point is next with Meghna Chakrabarty from WBUR Boston. It's 11 o'clock.